keep on pushing. I've got to keep on pushing. Mm-hmm. I can't stop now. Move up a little higher. Some way or somehow. 'Cause I've got my strength. And it don't make sense not to keep on pushing. Now maybe someday, I'll reach that higher goal. I know I can make it with just a little bit of soul. 'Cause I've got my strength and it don't make sense not to keep on.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, Morgan. Happy Friday.
Listen, yay. Okay. Let me just tell you, I am looking forward to this event. Like, I really, really am. How you doing over there?
I'm doing good. And when you said, this is how I need to slow my brain down. When you said Friday, I thought about McDonald's French fries. And then when I thought about McDonald's French fries, no, I'm going to take this deep. When I thought about McDonald's French fries, I thought about how I used to love to get Happy Meals as a kid. Then when I thought about Happy Meals, I thought about this sermon I just saw from Sarah Jakes, where she was like, remember that the thing that you used to desire the most is now the thing that you desire the least. She was like, now you couldn't even imagine going through a drive-thru trying to get you a Happy Meal. And she was just like, in this sermon, I thought all of that in about the 1.8 seconds that you said that. And I need to just calm my life down. That's all you need to know.
No, that's why I roll with you. Because if we was on the Amazing Race, you would think of 17 different ways to get around the obstacle. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, God. Please cast Morgan and I on the Amazing Race, y'all. We would be so good. We would represent the movement. I would. I would represent the movement.
Vanessa, can I tell you about what we're about to talk about today? Is going to blow your whole entire mind. Not even half your mind.
Your whole. Because
here I am.
Freedom Friday. Freedom Friday.
My whole black. This is the blackest Black August ever. This is the freest Freedom Friday ever. Yes. Let me tell you something. I was straight up ignorant about A. Philip Randolph. Like, straight up ignorant. I knew he was the man on the March on Washington, Vanessa. And you did, too. That he was, like, in them pictures of Martin Luther King and them. But when I tell
you... But I didn't know that. Or just remember, you only just told me. I don't know. This is when... I'm learning. I did not know the details.
Yes.
The details. Remember, you were like, no, he's in all the photos. And I was like, oh, I did not know that. I had to go back to
yes. That. He's head in all the photos on the March on Washington with Dr. King and Bayard Rustin. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, he's, you know, the labor organizer, you know, listen, I'm about to teach y'all today because I've been in it. I've been watching the documentaries. I've been doing the research. I'm in it. Let's take you back. First of all, I want you to hear A. Philip Randolph's voice, because when you hear his voice, I mean, he was a Shakespearean actor, Vanessa, when he moved to Harlem, and you hear his voice, all of this is going to start to make more sense. So, Ebony, can you just play the first clip, which was him welcoming people to the March on Washington, because he was the lead organizer.
And Morgan, who was the song that we listened to when we first came on, by the way? I don't even know who
that was. The Impressions. Keep on pushing. That's his name. Yes, it was good, girl. That's my jam. It reminds me of Black Men Working Hard, and we're going to talk about that today. So I thought it was just such... Curtis Mayfield used to be in The Impressions, and he's just such an oracle and just like such a voice of the generation. So we wanted to play that today. So, Ebony, do you have that clip ready of A. Philip Randolph opening up the March on Washington?
Oh, Fearing violence, the AFL-CIO refused to endorse the march. But Randolph won financial support from the United Auto Workers and various religious groups. After a lifetime of calls for mass action, A. Philip Randolph gave the first speech at the March on Washington.
Fellow Americans, we are gathered here in the largest demonstration in the history of this nation. Let the nation and the world know the meaning of our numbers. We are not a pressure group. We are not an organization or a group of organizations. We are not a mob. We are the advance guard of a massive moral revolution for jobs and freedom.
Thank you, Ebony. We are not a group of organizations. We are an outright revolution for jobs and freedom, is what he said in the opening words. With all of those people crowded into our nation capital, the biggest mass demonstration in United States history. A. Philip Randolph was born in 1889, just 20 years after slavery ended in Florida. He grew up actually in Jacksonville, Florida. Shout out to our friends there in Jacksonville. And this is so prophetic. He was born to a preacher, and his mother was fierce. Actually, one time there was a lynching near them, and his dad put a pistol under his coat, went out to demand justice for that lynching, and the mom sat on the porch with a rifle on her lap. Vanessa, that was his parents. Mm. And at the dinner table, they talked to their kids about what was possible for their lives. And I just encourage dinner around the table, y'all. I encourage those kinds of conversations.
Yeah, or walk and talk more. Morgan, just like this
or
one,
walk
just
and
as
talk.
A reminder
yes.
to everyone that that's
yes.
exactly why we structured these podcasts as walking podcasts. And Morgan and I right now are out walking on day 10, by the way, of Black History Bootcamp. Hey, everyone, because of this exact thing, Morgan. So, yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Actually, I talked to a girlfriend who said she was with her 18-year-old daughter, and she told her daughter she was going to walk with her, that she was making her daughter walk with her. And the daughter had attitude because when you're 18, you don't want to go for a walk with your mama. And she was like, well, I want you to listen to this podcast. And the daughter was like, you know what podcasts are? She was like, yes, I want you to listen. So they both put their earbuds
yes.
in. And then her daughter started laughing because we was arguing. And she was like, are they arguing? And then Paul was like, just listen. And she said she kept trying not to laugh, but she was. And I was like, this is
right.
really, we are creating our own revolution. Y'all believe that. Believe that.
Yeah.
So let me tell you about A. Philip Randolph. First of all, his parent, the A stands for Asa, and it was after a king in the Bible who distributed all of his wealth to his people. And I was like, that is prophetic. You better name your kids something you want them to be. And I was like, listen up. So A. Philip Randolph, he grew up in the South, and he couldn't get a job in the South after he graduated from high school, so he went to Harlem. It was early 1900s. Harlem was popping. He had read W.E.B. Du Bois, Soul of Black Folks. He was like, I'm going to Harlem. He went up to Harlem. And when he got there, he helped organize a Shakespearean theater group, and he played Othello, he played Romeo, and some other. I mean, he first of all was real fine when he was young. I mean, real fine in this way. And he had like poise and all the pictures. He's just looking right. straight at the camera. He had conviction, Vanessa. Listen, so he started going to City College right there in Harlem, and this was around the time when the socialist movement was popping. I mean, socialist movement meant that we didn't want any classism. We wanted a classless society, and we wanted the people to get what they were worth and what they were paid for. So he was very much into socialism, but as you can imagine, what's that, the truck? A garbage truck.
Oh, look, I'm walking. Sorry, y'all. Yes.
No, it's perfect. It's perfect because he started to, you're going to figure out why that's perfect, because all of the men who were working at garbage trucks, all of our city workers, men and women, I just want to tell you that I thank you on behalf of all of the people who organized
yes.
over the years. We
yes.
right now have the society that we have because of you. So it's fortuitous that
yes.
a garbage truck just backed up by you. But anyway,
and I'm not even lying, Morgan, just putting it out there that on high on my list of potential new boo candidates is a hardworking man who could just you know, pick up the trash, come home, be happy.
I'm taking applications, and I'll be looking. So it was, he was about 22, 23. He moved to Harlem and Vanessa. He started courting or dating this woman named Lucille Campbell Green. And she was a widow already. And she had already also been a professor. She was older than him, a professor at Howard University. And she moved to Harlem to be an entrepreneur with Madam C.J. Walker.
Stop. Eventually, we're going to have a Black History Bootcamp game. And when we do, or somebody needs to calculate right now, and we'll give them literally the best girl trick prize. I don't know how many times we have mentioned Howard University in this series of Black History Bootcamp.
Oh, it's the Mecca.
But I want to just shout them out. I mean, I want to shout out Howard University, because there is hardly a story that we have told that somehow does not connect back there. And man, we got to give the due where the due is done. Yes, yes.
Listen, I went to Howard University. If you also went to Howard University, share this podcast out. Everybody needs to know. So his wife went to Howard University. She became an entrepreneur with C.J. Walker. She opened up her own salon, Vanessa, and sold all of C.J. Walker's stuff. And she was a socialite. But he hated that, Vanessa. He hated them parties she went to. And he started this newspaper that was called The Messenger. And The Messenger was radical. And it was talking about the labor of Black people. It was urging people not to sign up for the draft to go to World War One until Black people were paid their dues. It talked about unionizing. And as you can imagine, the elite in Harlem did not want him at the parties. They was like, please don't bring your husband to this party, because we're trying to wear our single dresses and do our thing. And it was a little bit of friction, but he loved his wife and his wife loved him. And she was supporting him because he was in this burgeoning magazine and she was a baller. So she was like, go ahead and do your magazine, baby. Let's do this, right? They ended up having a 45-year marriage, Vanessa, until she passed away.
Wow.
It was really beautiful. So as you are imagining all of this work that he's doing, I want you to imagine Lucille by his side, holding him down, holding him up. So he was a socialist, and he was into a class of society, no distinction between the rich and the poor, everybody's equal. And he started a movement called the New Negro Radicals of Literary Intellectualism. Now, let me tell you, W.E.B. Du Bois was still alive, and he was all about the talented 10th and the bourgeoisie and coming together for social reform and NAACP and all that stuff, right? And his rival,
Morgan, I have a question right here. I have a question.
Yes.
What age were you when you read The Souls of Black Folk?
Probably like today age. I read it late. I read it like probably 15 years ago. Then I just read Booker T. Washington's book. I just read Booker T. Washington's book last year. And I didn't even read it. So
I had got bullied, Morgan. This is what I'm saying. When I was 13, I had got sent to summer camp because I won a scholarship from the IBTOW of the world for writing an essay about being a Black woman on the rise at 13.
Okay, we get to this. Hurry up.
No,
yes.
I got this scholarship to go to this camp, and I brought that book to read during the summer camp. And all the kids was like making fun of me. And I was like, and I'm saying that to say, I don't care. Like, if you have a young girl or boy at home, 13 is an appropriate age to read that. So give them the book then. That's what I was thinking. That's my story.
And if you're like me and you weren't an advanced reader as Vanessa was at 13, after her aunt, if you listen to the other boot camp, help her learn how to read, then you can actually go on YouTube and the books are read. No, I wasn't a good reader. You were a great reader. I'm saying you could go on YouTube and you can listen to somebody like, I think it was Ozzie Davis that reads Booker T. Washington's book, and you can listen to it in an hour. So there's so many options now. Anyway, Booker T. Washington believed in pulling yourself up from your bootstraps, working your way, going through the echelons, all this stuff. They disagreed on everything, y'all. But one thing they agreed on is that they hated A. Philip Randolph and these new radical Negroes. That's what's like, we can't stand these socialists who say there should be no distinction between classes, that the rich and poor should all have the same thing. It didn't fit into their paradigm. And A. Philip Randolph really did criticize W.E.B. Du Bois for supporting Woodrow Wilson in World War One. He was like, don't go off and fight in some man's war, and you can't go to Georgia and help people stop the lynching of Black men. I mean, he was calling them out in his magazine. And so had to pull over, it's raining. So he was calling them out. And so what happened next? So then this will happen. So he started talking about organizing and
laughing my
and
ass
all
over.
Of these.
You're a soldier.
Yes.
Wait, you was like, I got to pull over, it's raining. I'm just letting y'all know, like, we're walking, we're talking, we're remembering the past. I'm just shouting you out. You are a soldier for the movement. And I love this teaching you're doing. I'm listening. I can keep going.
Listen. So he started organizing people because he was talking about in the magazine and workers started coming to him. Because you have to imagine this was right around the time of, it was before the Great Depression, but it was 1919, which I don't know if you remember the Red Summer of 1919, which was before this last summer was the biggest summer of social unrest. There was like really violent clashes because people were really, really struggling with work and money and all sorts of things. We're about to go to war and people didn't want to go to war, the draft, all sorts of things. So workers started coming to him. He had a huge following. He was very popular. Workers started coming to him saying, can you help us organize a union like what you're talking about so we can have collective bargaining and ask for what we actually really need? So he was organizing people like elevator workers and people who worked at the docks. Okay, Vanessa, let me back up. So right after slavery, something happened that was really important. Steel, the metal steel, was you could create it for cheaper. It's something this man named Bessemer, called the Bessemer process. You could make steel for cheap. And what that did was it unleashed the industrial movement. So when you hear about people like Rockefeller, Carnegie, JP Morgan, even Ford, the reason why they could become multimillionaires is because of the steel process got cheap, right? So they started building railroads and ships and oil refineries and factories. And a lot of people argue that the Civil War was about the North and these wealthy industrialists needing cheap labor, okay? So they fought the Civil War, free the enslaved Black people, and Black people got to be their free labor, right? So one of the things that happened is we started building the railroad. If you watch 13, that documentary, we started building the railroad. Right after that, there was a man named George Pullman. Yes, this man named George Pullman, who was a white man, who had this brilliant idea. He was going to put sleeping cars on the railroad, which was like a hotel, like a traveling hotel, essentially, where the people, white people could feel wealthy because it was segregated. White people could feel wealthy, be in this plush, opulent environment. And he staffed them intentionally with Black men who were formerly enslaved to be the servants. This is after slavery is over, but to essentially act as servants on these trains. Well, Black people were like, this is a good job. I get paid every day. Like, I get to be on these fancy things. I get to dress sharp. The Pullman porters is what they were called after George Pullman. The Pullman porters became instant like status. I mean, Black men from everywhere, the best, the fine. I mean, Google Pullman porters, the finest Black men, I mean, they was in their uniform with their hats on, looking good. And they was like, yes, sir, can I take your
only
order?
Rivaled by the shoe shiners, Morgan, because you know them shoe
only to be rivaled by
fine.
The shoe shiners. They was also fine. But so they got on, and Vanessa, he became the largest employer of Black people in the country. George Pullman and the Pullman Company, the largest employer of Black people in the country. That's important. I'm gonna tell you why. Well, years passed. The Pullman porters was in movies. Everybody wanted to date a Pullman porter. I mean, it was like that. But he started to exploit their labor, right? And they was only making like 15. At one point, they was only making like $15 a week. But they had to pay half of it back to sleep on the train at night. They were working 80 hours a week, Vanessa. They were going through the South where it was dangerous. Nobody would give them tips. And they really did thrive on tips because they weren't getting paid enough. They got more and more disgruntled and really justifiably so because they were getting paid pennies, right? And the world was changing and their servile, the expectation that they were going to be servile Black men, yes, sir, no, sir. Even the people didn't even call them by their name. They called them all George after George Pullman. They was like, hey, George. And they was like, okay, touch your forehead, something gonna have to change. So they started organizing. They also started reading A. Philip Randolph magazine. So a group of them, shout out to organizers and companies, went to A. Philip Randolph and said, listen, brother, we can't organize because they will fire us, but you can organize us. Will you come and organize the Pullman porters? It was one night, Vanessa, you mentioned the Elks. It was one night in Harlem in August 25th, 1925. I remember them 25s, okay? August 25th, 1925, under the cover of night in Harlem. This happened. Ebony, play the clip. Play the clip, Ebony. Play the clip. This is the act of resistance that happened.
On August 25th, 1925, Randolph arranged a secret meeting with the porters at the Imperial Lodge of Elks on 129th Street in Harlem. 500 attended.
It was quite a meeting, because there was great fear among the porters, you know, that stool pigeons would penetrate the meeting and carry news back to the superintendent, to who was there. And the superintendents were ruthless and would fire a porter if he had the slightest idea that he was trying to become a part of the union. And then I got up and told them, you have to take responsibility upon your own shoulders, building something upon which you can depend, that you'll get what you can take and keep what you can hold. You can't take anything without power, and you can't hold anything without power. And you can't get power unless you're organized. You could hear a pin fall, because it was looked upon as simply hopeless to try to organize a group of men who run the grip, the moral and intellectual and economic grip of a mighty corporation such as the Pullman Company was.
We meet today and freedom called and raise our voices high. We'll join our hands in union strong to battle or to die.
The following day, more than 200 men poured into the messenger's office to join the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters Union.
All right. Thank you so much, Ebony. That became, Vanessa, the first black union in America. The Brotherhood for Sleeping Car Porters, they unionized, and it was just 200 people who signed up in his office. They were scared. There was retaliation. There was beatings. People lost their jobs, and they were scared. And so they first joined. And what you have to understand, Vanessa, is this was the time when the Bolshevik Revolution was happening. Did you ever read Animal Farm back in the day?
Yeah.
Did you ever read that book? When the when all the animals
when
united
the pigs,
and they overthrew the farmer.
Yes,
that's the Bolshevik Revolution that happened in Russia. That was happening at this time in real life. So the farmers and the workers of Russia were overthrowing the capitalists in Russia. So people were terrified. So people like retaliated, like, no, this is not gonna happen. So what happened is he got on the trains like we did for the Road to Selma. He went from city to city and he organized in 39 cities, all the different porters. And so eventually he got 51% of the porters to sign up for this union. It was 20,000 black men who signed up for this union. And that was all it took. That was all it took. He was able to get legislation passed with FDR, and he got $2 million extra dollars in the pockets of Pullman porters, shorter work week, overtime pay, all the things that actually started to create the black middle class, because people had time with their families. They had enough money in their pockets to buy homes, all sorts of things because of A. Philip Randolph. But he did not stop there, Vanessa, because he could have. He could have stopped there with the biggest black union ever in the history of America and fighting the biggest corporation. He could have stopped there, but he used that power and he went to FDR and he stood in his office, Vanessa, and I ain't going to play the clip, but y'all need to watch that documentary. Thank God for PBS. Thank God for PBS. But he went into FDR's office in the Oval Office and he said, listen here, we're about to go to war. He was like, and there is pre-war factories all over, springing up all across this country. But the federal government is the most discriminatory agency in this entire country. And you're not hiring black people, and you have to hire black people. And if you don't, we are going to protest all over your White House. This is what he said to them. This is what he said to him in his own words. And FDR was like, are you saying that we're racist? I'm not racist. We're the most democratic. And he said, open up the federal jobs. Vanessa, in 1 year, one executive act from FDR, 1 year, a million jobs went to Black people because of A. Philip Randolph. And he didn't stop there. Then he was like, and we ain't going to fight your war. And so the next presidency, Truman, he was like, listen, Truman, you better desegregate the military. If you don't desegregate the military, we ain't going to fight no war. Because even the blood banks were segregated, Vanessa. They wouldn't even give you blood from a white man if you fell on the field right. in World War One. Right. So for World War II, he was like, we're not going to fight. He said, unless you desegregate, guess what happened? Truman signed an executive order because he needed that Black vote. And A. Philip Randolph was the pinnacle of Black leadership at that time. He had the most people power. And so they signed the executive order to desegregate the military because of A. Philip Randolph. So these wow. three huge victories you think would be enough. But he met this young, fired up activist in his military work, desegregating the military. And his name was Bayard Rustin. And he was inspired by Bayard Rustin. And he was like, we about to do something huge. I've been promising to march on Washington. We going to march on Washington for jobs and for freedom and for economic power. His wife passed away, Vanessa, and he almost fell into a depression. And he was like this. And so he threw his everything into that march on Washington. Here's what is so crazy that I learned. It's the last bit that I learned is that when Rosa Parks, so the civil rights movement was also starting at this time. This, he had been in the game for 30 years. The civil rights movement was starting. There was all sorts of people. There was SNCC with John Lewis, rest in peace, who just passed away. The young people, SNCC. There was CORE with John Farmer. There was NAACP with, I can't remember his name. And there was Martin Luther King with the Southern Leadership or Southern Christian Leadership Council. But they were all disparate. They were all like all over the place. And they fought all the time. They didn't like each other really that much, like personally. And they fought all the time.
Yeah.
It was A. Philip Randolph who made them sit in a room together. There are pictures of them. And he looked like the godfather, Vanessa. And he's like, no. Y'all going to come together. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to march on Washington. At the same time, they were organizing. And Rosa Parks sat on the bus. We already learned about Claudette. She came and it was organized effort. But after she sat on the bus and got arrested, it was a Pullman porter, by his last name was Nixon, N-I-X-O-N, a Pullman porter who had the idea to boycott the buses. He called A. Philip Randolph and said, did you hear about this woman, Rosa Parks, who just sat down? This is the moment. We should boycott the buses. A. Philip Randolph called the Kennedys. A. Philip Randolph called the people. And then he said, well, call Martin Luther King. He's a young preacher there and invite him to join it with you. Martin Luther King wasn't having nothing to do with it. He was like, no, I don't sound right. I don't know if I'm going to do this. He was like, I'm going to just go preach this Sunday. I don't know. A. Philip Randolph got involved. Martin Luther King called back and was like, I'm in. The civil rights movement would not exist without this man is what we need to know. So they went on the march on Washington. Everybody came. And here we are. History was made. The Voting Rights Act came out of that. And the Civil Rights Act. Two of the most pivotal pieces of legislation that we owe everything to. And I want to say that the most impactful organizer in U.S. history is arguably A. Philip Randolph. I didn't know none of that, Vanessa. That's all you need to know. I didn't know none of that. So my first question to you is, why don't we know any of that? Why? How is it that I could study African-American history in college? How is it that I could be a history teacher and I don't know none of that? What do you think is the reason why?
Tell me.
I don't know. It's a genuine question. I don't know. Why don't we know? Why
I don't know either. No, I know. That's
know
what I'm saying.
A. Like, Philip Randolph. I don't. I think.
I mean, I have some
people
ideas.
Like W.E.B. Du Bois, and I think they didn't like him because he was a socialist, and because we were bought into a capitalist system, and socialist was a scary and bad word. I really think that's what it was.
Yeah.
I also think that he didn't do things in the limelight. He wasn't the person in the forefront ever. He was the organizer behind the scenes, and I think we forget the workers. I think
right,
we forget the workers in history.
Yeah, I do think we forget the workers. And I think that there are some people who just move in silence, you know, and because I think some of the what we see celebrated are people who also strategically, for no judgment, sought the spotlight as part of their platform of their work even. So just there are some people who even just like move in silence, I think. And then their stories over time in history become told less and less a little bit. And I think there's even a lesson in that for all of us, maybe somewhere. I don't know what it is, but
there is. There is, yeah. Like, the attorney general eventually called him the most dangerous Negro in America. He said, because he was like, he literally can snap his fingers and massive amounts of workers and people, like the real Black people in America, will come because he earned their respect.
Yeah.
There's a story that I really loved when he was on the road organizing the Pullman porters. He was broke, Vanessa. He didn't have any money. I mean, he was a magazine man. He didn't have any money. And the wives of the Pullman porters were raising money for him for bus fare so he could go from city to city. And there was a story about he had like holes in his shirt.
As an organizer, like, he, right? You're saying that as an
organizer. Yes, as an organizer.
Which
as
also organizer is, back in the is day. Crazy because I was talking to one of our partners yesterday around like philanthropy. And we were having a conversation around equity. And it's just like there are so many today, A. Phillips, who are out there, organizers, doing this good work, and they can't put food on their tables or they can't pay their bills. And we just haven't figured out like a system in which we can support those of us who are really locally on the ground in the ways, in better ways.
That's a challenge to us, Vanessa. We should, while we have any spotlight, we should figure out a way to support grassroots organizers who are in the causes already.
Yeah.
You know, not people who come through Girl Trek looking for opportunities, but people who are already in the street. So it's like a real call to action for me. Yeah. So, but the women would come and they would mend his shirts while he was talking. Like, I was like, I love Black women. Okay. I love the Black women.
Plait your hair, mend your shirt, fry you some chicken. Like,
are you still going to wrap up in a second? We can wrap up.
No, I don't want to wrap up though, Morgan.
No,
I have three things that I've been thinking through. These things are off base of this conversation, but not, but I wanted to hear the whole story before, and I didn't want to interrupt. But there are three things that are just top of mind. One, please, everyone on this call, in the age where we have so much misinformation, support public broadcast. When you were saying, like, thank God, PBS, it just popped into my mind. Like, we actually have to become stewards and givers of public broadcast. It is a treasure in this country, and we need, like, real information out there. Black History Bootcamp is real information as well, and public broadcast, and I just want people to support them. And then one of the other things I thought it was, when you were talking about what was happening in Russia, I actually just wanted to shout out that yesterday I had learned about, and I don't, you know, this is one of those things is like where if we knew the revolutions that were happening around the world, we would all become stronger as a revolution. But I didn't know that there was this revolution happening right now in Belarus. And it's like this female uprising of women who are like taking, I'm going to summarize it completely wrong, but fighting back, running for president, doing this stuff. And it's just a movement of women. And I'm just now starting to learn about it. I just wanted to like uplift that movement and all the other movements around the world, because I think that energetically our frequencies are all connected when we vibrate. And then the last thing I had thought was that when you were talking about they even segregated the blood banks, I was like, and I just wanted to let everybody know that there was a Black man. Remember I think his name was like Dr. Drew or Dr. Charles Drew or something like that. But
Charles
he is the man who like discovered platelets, and it was during World War II. And it was like such a huge discovery that America was like, yes, and we got it, like, this is now going to save the war because the soldiers won't be like dying out. This Black man discovered it. Then the Black man was like, yeah, we can create this American Red Cross. But he was like, but how I'm going to be the head of the American Red Cross and you have these segregated blood banks. He was like, and I'm a Black man and I discovered the platelets. So, and I believe and I could be telling this story completely wrong, so we might tell it better in another episode, but I believe he completely resigned. And so those three things just were top of mind as you were telling this story. Like, there's just so much interconnectedness.
But it's also like I was looking for music for the soundtrack, and the blues was also like really popular then. So, I mean, if you think about the tapestry of what's happening, you think about what we talked about yesterday with Mary Church Terrell. You think about what we talked about before with the revivals that were happening in backwoods and the spiritual revival that was happening with Black people. You think about all of these things together and Charles Drew discovering platelets and what was happening in Harlem and W.B. Du Bois in the 1919 riots and World War I, World War II, then the Great Depression. I mean, it's like all of that was happening in a 20-year span. And I am so grateful for them soldiers who was out there doing it for us. I'm so grateful. It gives me so much fortitude.
Yeah,
like,
too.
This ain't
me
nothing,
too.
Y'all. What we have coming in front of us ain't nothing. And we better start to learn the resistance strategy of our foremothers and our forefathers and resist. We have to
it's
resist.
Funny. It's funny you even said that word, gratitude, Morgan, because at the beginning of the call, I was going to say first clip of him talking at the March plate. I was like, wow, I'm kind of like getting emotional because I was like, I just have like a great sense of gratitude for the work that they did for those brave men and women. I was thinking like, you and I know like what it is to like try to write an email and try to get like the exact perfect words right and try to like move people to like some sort of, and I'm like, I'm just saying these were just regular men and women who just rose to the occasion of the moment, who poured their heart into words and strategies and time and basements. And it's just, I was just like, man, if I could only do like just a portion of the work that they have done in some sort of way, I just want God to use me in that way.
Me too. Me too. And I want that for you too. And John Lewis, I was listening to this one little itty bitty 2 minute clip of John Lewis talking about A. Philip Randolph. And, you know, John Lewis got what he deserved, which was this beautiful pomp and circumstance ceremony of like a king when he passed away a few weeks ago. And I was grateful for that. And I just think like actually, A. Philip Randolph lived in a little New York City apartment after his wife died by himself, Vanessa, and he lived to be 90 years old, and he passed away peacefully at 90 years old, a life well lived. And I'm just so grateful for that. But John Lewis said, in any other society where race was not an issue, this man would have been the president. He would have been the prime minister. He would have been something. He said one time he came up, they was going to see, I think it was Kennedy. They was going to see Kennedy, and he was like, Sir President, he was like, the black masses are rallying. I suggest. He was like, I suggest that you
in that voice, in that tone of voice.
Yes,
did you hear him?
Yes,
because he was, yes. He could command some stuff with that voice. Yes.
The black masses are rallying. I was like, no, as we close this out, one thing to note is that collective organizing did not exist in this way before A. Philip Randolph. He was the one who kept like leveraging the strategic approach that we gonna march you down, that we gonna bring thousands of people to look you in the face unless you look me back in the eye and tell me what I need to hear. Like that was really kind of, he really started that. So every time we see all these environmental activists or whatever, he was one of the masterminds of that kind of collective demonstration in America. He really was. So I'm super, super, super grateful for our ancestors. And the last thing I'll say is, remember on Life, remember that movie Life when they was at the end? It was so sad, that movie. At the end, they were playing like having people's pictures fade away, like all the different people in the prison. I was thinking in my head, because my head works like this, I was like, what would we not have on this earth if A. Philip Randolph never was born? And all these pictures of the March on Washington, of the Montgomery bus boycott, of the sleeping car porters, of all of this labor organized, none of that would have happened. And you know what else would not have happened? This speech that we're about to listen to. We will talk to you guys all tomorrow. Thank you for tuning in to Black History Bootcamp.
It's Friday, Morgan. Hold on. It's Friday.
You're right.
Friday. Remember the story. We will be back live. We take a break every weekend so that we can invite our sisters, our brothers, our colleagues, our coworkers, our clergymen, our congresspeople, Michelle Obama, Oprah, so that we can invite every person we know to join us on Monday live for these conversations, or to catch up over the weekend on any episodes that they were missed so that they can be a part of this conversation. This is the power of organizing in action right now, Morgan. If every single person in the sound of our voice invites five other people to join and to catch up on some episodes over the weekend, we could, you know, triple our listenership, which then triples the goodness and the stories and the legacy of these people. So please help us do that. And then we'll be back on Monday. And then also I have a request. I'm thinking hard, Morgan, about who we're going to cover on Monday. And if any of y'all have suggestions, I'm going left, I'm going right. I just wanted to remind everyone that this is 21 acts of resistance. And so we're looking for the pivotal moments, the bravery, the courageous decisions, the people who stood up, the little guys, the stories that we've been telling over the last 10 days. If you have a suggestion, we're building this together. Hashtag Black History Bootcamp is someone you want us to cover. And over the next 10 days, we have 11 more episodes to go for this round. We may cover one of those people. So that was it.
We're halfway, y'all. We're halfway.
Yes.
We do 21 days because 21 is how you build a habit, and walking every day is a life-saving habit, and Black women are dying disproportionately from the stress of the world, from obesity-related diseases, from being stuck, y'all. So we are not stuck anymore. We are walking out of our front doors for better health. And if you can do it for 21 days, hang in there, y'all. We promise it's going to be a life-saving habit. So we're halfway there. Congratulations, everyone. Now, let's pay our respect. Let's listen out to the words of the March on Washington. We love you all.
Bye, y'all.
A philosopher of a nonviolent system of behavior is seeking to bring about social change for the advancement of justice and freedom and human dignity. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
When he introduced King, it was poetic. There were no dry eyes. Symbolically, it was like passing the torch from one generation of fighters to a new generation of fighters.
Let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring when we have it. When we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, Black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last.